live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. All over the world, people are wanting to be healthier and happier. And we're happy that they come here each day so we can share insights and information that can empower them. Today, the latest on healing, including life-extending mechanisms of rhodiola. We're also going to look at antioxidants that help with Parkinson's and flaxseed. It really does your heart a lot of good. And turmeric. It can produce some remarkable improvements with dementia. We also are going to look at a few comments today on spying on Americans. From Norman Solomon from Global Research, a letter to Senator Feinstein, who fully supports and is one of the strongest advocates of spying on Americans. So he has a letter. I'll read it. Then from Larry Chen from Global Research, 9/11 and the military intelligence security machine towards a permanent state of emergency in America. A short commentary by him. Then Bank of America whistleblowers are saying, we were told to lie and rip off borrowers, and we did in big numbers. So why aren't those people who ripped off the borrowers, why aren't they being charged? And also today we will look at, no, the National Security Agency spying did not prevent a terror attack on Wall Street. And also a letter to Bono, because most people, when they hear his name and they see him at all these world conferences, they assume he's out there doing the people's bidding. He is not. It's time that you knew who he was representing. George Montebiot, why do Bono and the One campaign really represent the very rich? Well, he's going to tell us. For the second part of our program today, we're continuing with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series. Dr. Colin Campbell, he's been at the forefront of nutrition research. He is currently the Jacob Gould Schumann Professor Emeritus of Nutritional Biochemistry at Cornell University, and he is on the board of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. And keep in mind, he was the one responsible for the China Project, the most comprehensive study ever performed on an animal-based diet, a meat-based diet, in relationship to diseases. And he did that with Cornell and Oxford University and the Chinese Academy of Preventive Medicine 20 years ago. Today, we're going to talk about the need for a revolution in nutritional science and failures of reductionist science in understanding the medicinal properties of food. As you see, we have a lot to share. Let's begin. One of the foods that we could be consuming on a regular basis are flax seeds. But if you ate just the whole flax seed, they're not going to digest. So it's best to get the flaxseed meal, or even better, the flaxseed oil. And hence I suggest 1 to 2 tablespoons a day of the flaxseed oil. It's rich in the omega-3 fatty acids, the same fatty acids that help your heart that are, let's say, from fish oil. This is the latest information. This is from the biomedical literature in the National Library of Medicine's biographic citation, what is called Medline, and things that can help your heart. And there are over 129 of these studies on flaxseed. And it talks about its cardiovascular disease preventing and reversing role. Just one example. The American Journal of Physiology and Circulation Research titled, quote, The Effects of Dietary Flaxseed on Atherosclerotic Plaque Regression. That means reversing it. And then it looked at whether or not it was able to do it and found out that it was. Quote, this is from the study. Dietary flaxseed can retard the progression of atherosclerotic plaques. So that's important. So once again, that's just one item. Now imagine if it were synergistically added to all the other things we know will help reverse plaque buildup. And probably 40% of all Americans have plaque buildup, and that leads to atherosclerosis. Another study, quote, dietary flaxseed is a valuable strategy to accelerating the regression of atherosclerotic plaques, end quote. Now, mind you, that's just one of many studies showing what flaxseed does just on the pathological process that leads to death. The journal Atherosclerosis published a study that flaxseed can provide an ideal solution for aging women following the failure of their ovarian reserve in the mid-40s and late 50s, when they begin to develop adverse changes in their blood lipids and increase atherosclerotic lesions. And what they found was that dietary flaxseed was as effective as estrogen or estradiol for preventing some of the adverse blood lipid changes associated with the change of life. And it was capable of preventing fatty streak areas around the lesions that can lead to heart attacks. And then how does flaxseed cardiovascular benefits work? It's relatively simple. There are three primary beneficial compounds. They're the omega-3s, known as alpha linoleic acid, and that's a fatty acid. And we don't get a lot of it in the Western diet, but it's essential to human metabolism, meaning we can't produce it ourselves, and you must get it from an outside source, but it can help reduce the risk of heart disease. And then you have soluble fiber. Now, that's a big one, because flaxseed is a very rich source of soluble fiber, and that helps bind with bile acids, which include oxidized cholesterol and other fat-soluble waste products like toxic hormone metabolites and other bile constituents, and they get thrown out of the body through your feces. And then we have what are called lignans, L-I-G-N-A-N. Lignans are a class of plant compounds with both estrogen-like and antioxidant properties. And the major lignin found in flaxseed is metabolized into a enterolactone, which within the body has a lot of beneficial outcomes, including helping your cardiovascular system. So, one more reason why you should be taking your flaxseed. And also for men, there was a very important study that showed that flaxseed improves urinary tract symptoms with men who have benign prostatic hyperplasia. And it also helps against radiation. There was a 2009 study that found that flaxseed prevents radiation-induced oxidative lung damage and inflammation and fibrosis in a mouse model. And it's helps improve the quality of your skin. It diminishes skin sensitivity and improves skin barrier function. So it's really good. So I always like to share things that are inexpensive. It's not expensive. Easy to use, is completely non-toxic, and has a myriad of benefits. You could use 1 tablespoon of the ground flaxseed daily, and because you can't chew it. You'll never chew it up, masticate it adequately to get the nutrients out of it, or take the oil. Now, another thing we should be using daily is called turmeric. Turmeric is very powerful. There's a very good story and about how turmeric helps with dementia. And so I read the article, and indeed it does help with the mental state. So turmeric produces recovery from dementia symptoms, and there were multiple cases, so it wasn't just one study. It was multiple studies. Now, the active ingredient in turmeric, about 1 gram of turmeric daily, for 3 months showed, quote, remarkable improvements, but it's curcumin. So rather than take turmeric, I'm suggesting people who really want the benefit take curcumin, and therefore get it in concentrated quantities. And curcumin, which, by the way, is a phenomenal antioxidant, and it's really strong in its anti-inflammatory and lipophilic action, improves the cognitive function in patients with Alzheimer's. And that is important. So from the Annals of Indian Academy of Neurology from 2008. Turmeric's natural antioxidant and inflammatory and detoxifying mechanisms helps improve memory in patients with dementia. How about that? So that's inexpensive and easy to use. I'm suggesting with dementia and Alzheimer's, you start at about 3,000 milligrams a day in divided doses, then go up from there to probably 5 or 6. And then for those who have irritable bowel syndrome, and that's very common, and that's because a lot of people are highly stressed, and then you end up with spastic colon, and orthodox medicine has nothing that's going to cure a spastic colon or irritable bowel syndrome. But the disease is characterized by being in remission and then inflammation, flare-ups. So I always suggest people try hypnotherapy and then to relax them so they don't overreact to stress. But then vitamin D every day, twice a day, at about 1,000 units, can make a difference along with good probiotics and aloe vera. This is from the University of Sheffield in England, published in the British Medical Journal. It talked about the paper reported on severe diarrhea, predominant irritable bowel syndrome for 25 years, and with no help. And then the person began taking vitamin D, and quote, the patient now takes 2,000 to 4,000 units of vitamin D3 daily. Dosage varies according to season, 2,000 in the summer, 3,000 to 4,000 in the winter, and that she, quote, in 3 years of supplementation, relapses only occur if supplementation has ceased. That's tremendous when you consider what it means to have explosive diarrhea all the time and pain all the time. And then when they take pain medications, it causes side effects, blurry vision, a lack of balance, insomnia. So, irritable bowel, vitamin D, a major therapeutic benefit. And there's lots of evidence on that. And also for diabetics, the new research shows that diabetic symptoms are linked to acute thiamine deficiency. Now, thiamine is vitamin B1. And so my suggestion, make sure you're getting 25 milligrams a day of B1, and that could help with diabetes. And finally, cocoa powder is effective in helping obesity-related inflammation. This is from Medical News, and it's talking about cocoa and how cocoa can make a difference in this particular laboratory model. So my suggestion is start using cocoa, 1 to 2 ounces a day of organic chocolate. That can make a difference and help you out. And finally, rhodiola. Rhodiola is important. This is the latest on it. This is from the journal PLOS One, an article that was just out last week ago. It talked about rhodiola rosea and extending the lifespan of fruit flies when administered orally. Now, we know it's an herb, and no one's ever looked at it in relationship to life expanding, but this study did. And then it was found to extend the life of worms and yeast. And so they did this University of California at Irvine. And that does not necessarily mean it would do the same in humans, but it is a good indicator. So it's, I would suggest considering that occasionally. And there's one other point. They've come up with a new antioxidant, a single compound, a naturally occurring compound called apocynin, A-P-O-C-Y-N-I-N, and it's found to protect the neurobehavioral function in mice with Parkinson's. And this was published in Neuroscience Letters. So when more research comes out on this, when it's available, I'll let you all know. Right now, I can't find it anywhere, but it's good research. I'm Gary Nall. We're here to share insights on what's important in our lives. Of course, health and nutrition, environmental issues are crucial. And for those of you who are listening, I'm going to be having a talkback segment. We have about 15 minutes before we go to our guest. Our guest is Dr. Colin Campbell. It'll be a conversation with remarkable minds and the need for a revolution in nutritional science and the failures of reductionist science that I talk about all the time on this show. But I wanted to share some other shorter pieces. And the first piece I'm going to share, and then I'd like your feedback, is what's happening in Congress, what's happening in the media. Now they're all starting to backpedal and downplay. Oh, you know, so you're spied upon, but they didn't listen to your phone calls. We disproved that yesterday. They don't read your emails. We disproved that. There's absolute evidence to the contrary. They're all lying. And this is a letter to to Dianne Feinstein. And she is one of the most powerful members of Congress, from Norman Solomon. And I'm posting this so you have it. Here's what it says. On Thursday, you responded to news about massive ongoing surveillance of phone records of people in the United States. You slipped past the meaning of the Fourth Amendment. As the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, you seem to be in the habit of treating the Bill of Rights as merely advisory. The Constitution doesn't get any better than this. Quote, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized, end quote. The greatness of the Fourth Amendment explains why so many Americans took it to heart in civics class and why so many of us treasure it today. But along with other high-ranking members of Congress and the President of the United States, you have continued to chip away at the sacred bedrock of civil liberties. As The Guardian reported the night before your sudden news conference, the leaked secret court order, quote, shows for the first time that under the Obama administration, the communications records of millions of U.S. citizens are being collected indiscriminately and in bulk, regardless of whether they are suspected of any wrongdoing, end quote. One of the most chilling parts of that just revealed surveillance court order can be found at the bottom of the first page, where it says, quote, declassify on April 12, 2038. Apparently you thought, or at least hoped, that we, the people of the United States, wouldn't find out for 25 years. And the fact that we learned about this extreme violation of our rights in 2013 instead of 2038 seems to bother you a lot. Rather than call for protection of the Fourth Amendment, you want authorities to catch and punish whoever leaked this secret order. You seem to fear that people can actually discover what their own government is doing to them with vast surveillance. Meanwhile, the executive branch is being run by kindred spirits as hostile to the First Amendment as to the Fourth. On Thursday night, Director of National Intelligence James Clapper issued a statement saying, quote, the unauthorized disclosure of a top-secret U.S. court document threatens potential long-standing and irreversible harm to our ability to identify and respond to many threats facing our nation, end quote. That statement from Clapper is utter and complete hogwash. Whoever leaked the four-page surveillance court document to Glenn Greenwald at The Guardian deserves a medal and an honorary parade down Pennsylvania Avenue in the nation's capital. The only threats assisted by disclosure of that document are the possibilities of meaningful public discourse and informed consent of the governed. Let's be candid about the most clear and present danger to our country's democratic values, the poisonous danger spewing from arrogance of power in the highest places. The antidotes depend upon transparency of sunlight that only whistleblowers, a free press, and an engaged citizenry can bring. As Glenn Greenwald tweeted after your news conference, quote, the reasons there are leakers is precisely because the government is filled with people like Dianne Feinstein who do horrendous things in secret. And he pointed out the real story isn't just the spying itself, it's that we have this massive, ubiquitous surveillance state operating in total secrecy. Obviously, you like it that way, and so do most other members of the Senate and House, and so does the President. You're all playing abhorrent roles, maintaining a destructive siege of precious civil liberties. while building a surveillance state, you're patting citizens on the head and telling them not to worry. Perhaps you should have a conversation with Al Gore and ask about his statement, quote, "Is it just me, or is the secret blanket surveillance obscenely outrageous?" Actually, many Americans understand that the blanket surveillance is obscenely outrageous. As your constituent, I would like to offer you an invitation. A short drive from your mega mansion overlooking the San Francisco Bay, hundreds of us will be meeting at a public forum on disappearing civil liberties in the United States. You're welcome to have my time on the panel. One of the speakers is Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, who could explain to you how the assaults on civil liberties and the wars you keep supporting go hand in hand, undermining the Constitution and causing untold misery. Senator Feinstein, your energetic contempt for the Bill of Rights is serving a bipartisan power structure that threatens to crush our democratic possibilities. A huge number of people in California and around the country will oppose your efforts for the surveillance state at every turn. Sincerely, Norman Solomon. Now, following that is this commentary from Larry Chin, C-H-I-N, from Global Research. We will post it. Quote, "The U.S. government is a criminal syndicate, openly committing atrocities on a global scale. The rule of law is a memory, buried in the rubble left by the false flag terror attack of 9/11, the manufactured war on terrorism, and the monstrosity of the Patriot Act. The legacy of 9/11 crime, the greatest intelligence success in history, is a permanent state of emergency, a criminal military intelligence war apparatus exemplified by the CIA, the National Security Agency, an unimaginable scope and unlimited power and endless war. This genuine evil is aided and abetted by the illiterate, willfully ignorant, and acquiescent American majority. The average American is uninformed, uninvolved, and well-conditioned to support wars abroad and enthusiastically welcome their own oppression. They applaud the security forces that commit atrocities, asking no questions, but begging these same forces to make them safe. A majority of Americans believe the original 9/11 lie and enthusiastically approve of police state mobilizations within our borders. The majority of Americans approve of being under surveillance, monitored, and tracked, their privacy willingly surrendered. Big Brother now openly, proudly promoting a police state. Washington's leaders bray about the greatness of military fascism and win votes for it. A majority of Americans, their brains addled with us versus them science fiction, monster movies, and pro-CIA entertainment propaganda, still cling to the fantasy they are the good guys who are endlessly under attack. So brazen, so certain that the passive U.S. population does not care, U.S. officials and the CIA are not even bothering to tell halfway believable lies. They know that questions in the wake of any terror incident will be not asked by the majority, no matter how many suspicions are left hanging. Today, they can openly admit their criminality and feel confident that there will be no consequences. U.S. government now supports and arms al-Qaeda all over the world. As written by Michael Chofskidowski, quote, "Those who lead the global war on terrorism in the name of democracy are those who are supporting and financing terrorist organizations, which they themselves created." Yet Americans do not care and scarcely notice that the official fairy tale has been routinely flipped this way and that way. The original 9/11 myth is so embedded into the brain synopsis that subsequent distortions of the big lie, no matter how outrageous or obvious, do not even register. Washington's war machine, foaming at the mouth to topple Syria, shipping yet more chemical weapons to al-Qaeda, is accusing the Syrian government of using chemical weapons while it rains chemical weapons on the Syrian government forces defending their nation from toppling. And Obama and Netanyahu accuse Syria of, quote, crossing red lines. This would be a comedy if not for the apocalyptic realities. War criminal and former President Bill Clinton is calling Obama, quote, a wuss or total fool if he does not take decisive action in Syria to assist the rebels, the al-Nusra, al-Qaeda terrorists. The fact that Clinton is calling for the massacre to escalate does not register to the American psyche. The American public loves Bill Clinton and know little, if anything, about the large-scale war crimes he committed as president. Adding to the spectacle, witness those who are running interference for the war security apparatus and laying waste to the illusion that there is no bipartisan cooperation on Capitol Hill. Senator Feinstein defends the National Security Agency domestic spying, pounding the podium and proclaiming, quote, it's a called protecting America. She's a liar and a warmonger. Her loyal liberal supporters do not understand this. Robert Mueller, who was intimately involved with 9/11 and declared 9/11 itself would have been prevented had domestic spying been pervasive prior to 9/11. Well, perhaps the key mastermind of 9/11 and its, or at least its cover-ups, would agree with him. They know damn well that America was already a total surveillance state prior to 9/11, and that today the spying power of the intelligence apparatus is even greater. As fully detailed in numerous books authored by James Bamford, the National Security Agency has had overwhelming surveillance power for decades. Whereas Michael Rupert detailed in Crossing the Rubicon, the U.S. government has used its worldwide technological advances, like Promise software, for example, to commit untold crimes. In conclusion, the Edward Snowden affair is but the tip of the horrifying iceberg. Surveillance, like war crimes and terror, will simply become even more pervasive and all-encompassing. To most Americans, it's like having new Facebook friends listening in. American ignorance is the intelligence war's machine's ultimate fuel. And here is the most telling sign of American times. George W. Bush is now a popular figure. A majority of the American public view him favorably. The post-9/11 Bush-Cheney-Obama dystopias are worsening. The military intelligence security machine marches on with hardy Americans' approval. End quote. Not everyone. There are a whole lot of people who are independent and progressive-minded, who understand what's at stake, and who are challenging it. I'm Gary Nall. Time for Talk Back, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. If you're listening over the telephone, which a huge number of people are, 619-550-0869. That's how you listen to this program over the phone. 619-550-0869. Before we go to our first call, let me just mention that we are all full for the upcoming retreat. It's going to be a wonderful experience for everyone. But I did reserve a few places for people who would like to be there as work study. And that way you get to take in a lot of the classes, but you also have to work. And if that interests you, and you save a lot of money. I'll give you a number to call, and you can call this number, and someone will get back to you. But I only have room for a couple. 877-627-5065. This is for work study, and I've always had work studied all 400 of the events I've done. 877-627-5065. That's just for work study for the July the 7th to the, whatever it is, 2 weeks. Retreat will be held, the yoga, meditation, cooking, detoxing, energy retreat. It's going to be the best ever. 877-627-5065 if you want to be considered for work study. All right? Let's say hello to Rick. Hi, Rick. Your turn.
Hi, Gary. I would like to try to give a little bit of background for my wife and I. I'm 59. She's 57. She was a stay-at-home mom and wife, and I was working. I worked in commercial banking, mortgage banking. Then I had my business as a trainer, trained people in mortgages and banking, and as a business consultant. Went back to school, was a PhD student, completed all my work except for my one semester and a dissertation. I wound up doing, due to bad circumstances of my own making and the economy back in 2009-2010, wound up broke, homeless, and for a little while living in a homeless shelter. What happened was that I lost touch with who I was and what it was about. And after we have worked with you for the past 4.5 months, My wife has lost a total of 70 pounds. I've lost a total of about 45 pounds. And I realize now that I have a totally different outlook on life, more physically fit than I've ever been before. And I realize that I have to keep my standards up what they are. I can't go down to other people's standards, and I have to live my life according to what I believe, and I'm not going to let other people in the future interfere with what it is that I want to do. And just wanted to say thank you for your help.
Why don't you, the most important element of what has happened, you left out. Let me ask you a few quick questions. Just give me the short answers, all right? Is it true that your wife has been suffering from clinical depression for about 20 years?
Yeah, she's about 17, 18 years. She's seen a total of like maybe 14, 15 different doctors, and nobody was able to diagnose. Well, they diagnosed what she had, but they were never able to help her.
Okay. Has your wife been depressed in the last 4 months?
She has not. She has not been depressed one day.
Does she have a sense of her own self-value and her own image of who she really is now?
She's getting that back. She hasn't had that in maybe 25 years.
Okay. Do you believe that that's one of the reasons she's lost 70 pounds and is happy?
Absolutely. They definitely go together hand in hand.
And what does it mean when all those dozens of doctors over all those years and all that treatment, they weren't able to help her, but she's helped herself. And so if she had the conditions that they said, and she limited herself to understanding her helplessness from the medical paradigm, she'd still be depressed. She's not. She'd still be overweight. She's not. She'd still be living only within your cycle of reality instead of creating her own sense of identity. Would you agree or disagree with that?
Oh, absolutely agree with that. Totally true.
So that's what means when you exchange a positive energy. And I think that is what we have to appreciate. It's all about the exchange of energy. What you choose to do, what you choose to think each day, ultimately determine who you are. So I'm very happy for you, and I'm very happy for your wife. And I understand you now have new insights, new talents, a new way of earning an income, and are on your way back to Oregon.
That's correct.
All the best to you and your wife, Evelyn.
Thank you.
My guest is standing by. In a moment, we'll go to him back in just 30 seconds.
When I was just a little girl, I asked my mother, what will I be? Will I be pretty? Will I be rich? Here's what she said to me. Que sera, sera.
Nice having you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, on the road. We are continuing with our conversations with Remarkable Minds today. The need for revolution in nutrition science and the failures of reductionist science in understanding the medical properties of food. My guest is Dr. Colin Campbell. I gave his introduction earlier. He is currently the Jacob Gould Schumann Professor Emeritus of Nutritional Biochemistry at Cornell University. And he is also the author of the groundbreaking book, Whole: Rethinking the Science of Nutrition, which goes into the cutting little edge of science for why a whole food plant-based diet provides optimal nutrition and why orthodox nutritional reductionism endangers maximum health. This website is tcolincampbell.org. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure.
When we look at interventions for preventing and treating disease and protocols for maintaining health, you speak of three primary criteria that we need to consider: rapidity, breadth, and depth. Would you please explain, first in the context of orthodox medical practice, including drug intervention, and state the failures of conventional medical practice in meeting these criteria, and then speak, please, in the context of adopting a whole food plant-based diet?
Your question really centers on the particular kind of study design that is used to assess information in the area of medicine and health. And what I'm referring to is the randomized clinical trial, I think, is the best way to put it. Most people in medicine and biological science think the randomized clinical trial is the gold standard, as they say. It is, to a great extent, the gold standard. You have a treatment group, you have a control group, both subjects in both groups being more or less the same except for the treatment. And that's good for testing individual chemicals like drugs to see whether it works or not. However, that does not apply in the case of nutrition, in my view, because, well, first off, in the drug situation, they can be double-blind. That is, both the investigator and the individual subject, neither one know exactly what the treatment is, whether it's the treatment or the placebo. So that's fair enough to call it the gold standard for that kind of test. Unfortunately, that same kind of design, though, does not apply to nutrition. First off, it can't be double-blinded. If we have groups of subjects, one group having one kind of diet, another group having another kind of diet, they obviously know what they're doing. They're not blinded to what they're eating, obviously. And even the investigator really doesn't know. But more to the point, in nutrition, it's not about one nutrient doing something. We can do that kind of study. We can take out a particular vitamin or mineral as such and treat one group and not the other group, if you will. And we can test it that way. But really, that's not an assessment of what the totality of nutrition is all about. The totality of nutrition really has to do with virtually countless things in food that operate through essentially countless mechanisms or functions within the body to produce a wide variety of outcomes. And it does it very quickly. So those three words you just introduced your question on, breadth, profoundness, if you will, and rapidity, are three terms that I've chosen to use because when we do the diet the right way, it has a very broad spectrum of effects in terms of just essentially total health. Encouraging good health, good energy, good physical activity, good mental activity on the one hand, and on the other hand, preventing various and sundry kind of diseases. So it has this amazing breadth. And the breadth occurs not because of one thing in that food that we're consuming, certainly not one thing. It's occurring because of the countless, almost highly synergetic effects, or I call it the symphonic effects, of all the nutrients operating together. And the results we get are truly amazing. So we have that breadth. At the same time, what we have now been observing, and I saw it some many years ago in the laboratory to some extent, is that the effect of food can operate very quickly. And so problems like pain, for example, or maybe even fairly advanced diseases, the effect can occur within days, maybe, certainly within a week or two. And so the rapidity with which it occurs, it competes with what the drug might do in relieving pain. I mean, it's really quite amazing. So that's breadth, rapidity. And the other thing is a hard word to come up with, the profundity or the profoundness of it. I'm talking about really life-saving things. I mean, to save one's life by changing their diet is a pretty profound accomplishment. And, others might, that's all a matter of judgment, but in any case, the effects are dramatic. And I just find this whole idea of this whole food plant-based diet not only to be good for preventing future problems, which to some extent we've known from the past, but these days we also know it is a means of treatment. And I find that really, really exciting because that's the basis for the entire medical industry to come up with some kind of prescription or this or that, you know, to get a result that the patient might like to have, you know, as quickly as possible. And a few people, I believe, really don't know how rapid the diet or nutritional effect can be because they've not been introduced into this particular kind of nutritional concept. Right. Sorry for the long answer, but that's about it.
I appreciate the insights you're sharing. I'm going to give a multi-approach issue and take it in any order you wish.
Okay.
On the one hand, you were one of the first to show us with the China study the impact of diet upon longevity and health. But in the United States today, more people are eating meat and dairy. We are fatter than ever before. We have obesity epidemics in children and diabetes, adult diabetes in children, type 2. Yesterday, the actor who had the Soprano died, and I was watching on television where they said, oh, this is so shocking, so surprising. And for me, I'm wondering, he's lucky that he lived to be 51. He was morbidly overweight. He was smoking all the time, drinking, had a poor diet. So they're excluding cause and effect. They're just looking at the inconvenience that he died at a young age. And we're looking at how many Americans are dying at a young age or having heart attacks or strokes, and no one's associating their diet. Now, I'm also a registered dietitian, aside from having a PhD in human nutrition. And when I was doing my dietetic studies, I found a study in a major peer-reviewed journal that showed that 50,000 individuals died of malnutrition each year in a hospital, eating hospital food. Now, that meant the physician that orders the meal plan and the dietitian that collects the nutrients and gives it were both failing, but neither stopped. There was no outcome that was negative to them. And then we look now, and the food in hospitals is an abomination. They have actually fast food franchises. You can get fried chicken. You can get all the saturated fat and animal protein you want. Even if you go in because of a heart attack, you can go downstairs and get your meal sent to you. And I'm thinking, where is this disconnect between what you believe and you have found in your long career of showing the relationship to where food should be a part of your healing process and part of your preventive process, and the complete disconnect where we're not looking at the role of food in its possibilities because mainstream science to this day refuses to acknowledge that there is either a preventative mechanism or healing mechanism outside of kwashiorkor or marasmus within food? That to me is just almost mind-blowing in its concept that we refuse to acknowledge the science of nutrition in helping to prevent or heal anything. Would you address any of these issues, please?
First off, I congratulate you, Gary. I know you've been doing this a long time, but the way you just said that is perfect. I'm in total 100% sync with your remarks. I think from my perspective, you were asking me from my perspective on this. I probably can speak to this from a somewhat unusual perspective in the sense that I was raised on a dairy farm. Milking cows. I mean, I really did. I milked cows from the time I was 5 years old until I went to graduate school, actually. And, you know, we ate the typical American diet, high in fat, high in protein, low in not so low in plants. We had a garden, so we had a bit of an advantage that way. But I went away to school, did my doctorate research on attempting to promote the consumption of protein, especially high-quality protein, which basically meant animal protein, milk, meat, and eggs. And so then I got, and I was in that rut. I was really within the paradigm that I guess most everyone else is, not knowing anything different, and not even in graduate school, not being taught this kind of thing. But then I got involved in doing research with many students and colleagues, and it was funded by the National Institutes of Health for the most part, and discovered that my previous views needed some new thinking, you know, some new considerations. And I focused on one particular question at the time, that was effective animal protein, if you will, on experimental cancer, saw some dramatic results. I said, hey, what is this about? You know, higher protein consumption, but especially when fed at above the levels we need. I mean, protein is an important nutrient, but fed at the levels above what we need, we have these serious problems. And so one thing led to another, and I think the rest of it was told, much of it was told in the China study, which I first wrote with my son. But and then I wrote the book called Whole after that just came out. And the China study was sort of attempting to describe what I found. And I was writing as much for myself, I guess, as anyone else, because I wanted to see if I could actually articulate this point of view. It's very complex biology, but to articulate a point of view that made sense. In a practical sense, but I never was able to explain exactly why. So the new book, Whole, is my attempt to explain why. Now, enough of that background. Let me just say a couple of things in reference to what you were talking about here about nutrition not being understood. I think I can make a case that the number one cause of death is not heart disease, as everyone says, and that's the way it's published. Number two cause of death is not cancer, and so forth down the list. the number one cause of death by far, I call it nutrition ignorance. Because I'm actually using real figures. If you take the percent of the total cancers that even most conservatively can be prevented by diet, if you take the number of heart disease cases and use, again, the most conservative figures, it turns out that the number one cause of death, nutrition ignorance, really does account for, I'm going to say, 60 to 80% of all deaths. An untold amount of misery and problems. So then the question arises, obviously, as you already pointed out, why haven't the medical profession embraced this idea? Well, it turns out it's not a medical school in the United States that actually takes it seriously. In fact, most places don't even offer even an elective course. Maybe an elective course here and there, but just a few lectures, not enough to really get people trained in the field. And so that's one problem. And those are kind of facts, essentially, inarguable facts. So when I recognized that, I was getting extremely frustrated during my career with sort of running across one observation after another that were considered heresies. And I sort of accept them as heresies in a sense myself until finally I realized, gosh, if you collect all these heresies together and put them in a list, you know, you have a new paradigm. I called them principles. So the new paradigm suggested to me something was totally outside of the realm of thinking and teaching. And I was involved in teaching the old way, too, myself. And the most important thing was the fact that, you know, in food has countless things that work together to create the fact the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, quite amazingly. It operates through countless, sort of sea change or a tsunami of different mechanisms to produce a whole variety of outcomes, namely associated with the prevention of disease or the promotion and maintenance of health. And so it becomes a really big story in my mind, a really big story. And then I just got more frustrated in many ways because I go back to my profession in biologic research, and I've worked a lot with NIH, both on both sides of the table, involved in basically getting funding ourselves. They were very generous that way, but on the other hand, sitting on the other side of the table deciding who else is supposed to get funding. So it was quite a lesson in being on policy committees, too. And I then just got this notion, I got to sit down and write this book and try to explain for myself what this is about. And it really has to do with the fact that what we do, I think the best sort of case to be made that I think we all have agreed to is that we tend to think of nutrition in a very reductionist way, as you just used the word, Gary, one nutrient at a time, doing one thing, and so forth. And so that, in turn, then raises a challenge to the medical profession itself. The entire medical industry, treatment, let's call it medical treatment industry, is really largely found in trying to, let's say, alleviate a problem on a very specific level. We're going to treat just this disease, that disease. So we have about 8,000 diseases that we can charge, you know, for our services. I think the number is around 8,000, say 800 or something, ICD codes. And now they're talking about increasing by to 75,000. So we get all these specific problems as if they're unrelated from each other. What a perfect model. A perfect model for a drug industry to sort of fall right into that forest. Because now we can just, with that thought in mind, we end up, you know, trying to create a specific chemical for each and every one of those conditions. And that's what we've told the public, and that's what the public tend to believe. And so when patients go to the doctor, they got a problem, they want to come out with a prescription. If the doctor doesn't give them a prescription, they feel cheated. In many cases, but majority of cases, I understand, according to the surveys on that. And so we're living in a different – the current world is wrong. And I really appreciate the kind of things that you've been doing over the years, Gary, on this point, trying to raise this level of consciousness. The current medical model is simply wrong. It's very, very expensive. It's the highest per capita cost of any country. We have the highest per capita cost of any country in the world by far, twice the size, number two, more or less. Yet we rank in between 35th and 40th in quality of health care, depending on, you know, how do you go about measuring that. And so it's a really rotten business model. I mean, it's a good business model for making money, but it's not a good model for making health. all because we just focus on one thing at a time. And I first really, that really brought home, that idea really came home to me when I was working, so to speak, inside a cell. And that was early part of my career. We really focused on, you know, all the different parts of the cell, from the nucleus to mitochondria, microsome, what have you. And we were working, probing quite deeply into the enzymatic reactions and how, you know, what belongs here, what belongs there, how do they relate, and so forth and so on. And it turns out each cell is like a universe unto itself. A real universe, if you measure atomic distances, there's huge, vast different distances between things. And yet, you know, with all that enormous complexity in a cell, you know, it operates so smoothly when you give it the right resources. It knows what to do. It really knows what to do. And I just liken it to, in a sense, sort of becoming conscious of becoming aware of what nature is really all about. And so the closer we get to understanding, really, first we have to be really awed. If people need to know what really is operating in this cell like that, and there's, we have somewhere between 10 and 100 trillion of those things around, and we can't even see one, let alone the other 10 or 100 trillion. And yet each one is just amazing. I'm sorry, I went on for too long. Yeah, Gary.
No, that's all right. We're interested in your,
appreciate your
rumination
me the
there.
Yeah.
Well, we have time for one last question.
Sorry.
And one of my greatest concerns is the dominant paradigm of genetic reductionism that's defining the trajectory of mainstream medicine. And it's extraordinarily primitive and simplistic and linear model for defining the onset of disease, and it certainly does not define life. And one thing it doesn't answer is causation of disease. It simply identifies a genetic anomaly without attempting to discover how the anomaly occurred in the first place. It's similar to me to the pre-Darwinian view of spontaneous generation, that maggots spontaneously generated from within rotting meat without realizing flies were laying their eggs in it. And this well describes how genetic reductionism views genetic causation of disease today. So would you share with us your insights on the genetic reductionist view when we're speaking about food and nutrition, because food and nutrition is getting zero input and genetic determinism is getting all of it. Look at Angelina Jolie's and some of the other recent headlines on this.
Great, great question. I've concerned myself with that for a long time. Some of our early research 30, 40 years ago was concerned with the question concerning which is more important in the causation of, let's say, a response. Is it the gene or is it the subsequent activities that occur after that? And we finally arrived at this view that, you know, virtually everything, whether it's physiological or pathological events, I mean, they all start with from a genetic basis, namely, you know, it starts with our DNA, if you will. And but it turns out that it's not whether or not we have a certain gene or combination of genes to give a certain response. That's not the issue. And even though everything starts there, we can say, okay, everything is caused by genes. I suppose that's a fair statement. But in reality, it's not the question of whether we have or don't have the genes. It's a question of what happens to the genes along the way. First off, and secondly, it's an enormously complex mixture of genes that usually end up producing a response we don't particularly care for. And so, and that response from genes to response, if you will, is what we call gene expression. And how do these genes get expressed? That's the role for nutrition. Nutrition really basically is operating, again, a very complex mixture of things, is operating on these genes, basically, to keep under control those genes we don't particularly care for and enhance the activity of those we do like. And so the nutritious sense is essentially encouraging, catalyzing the formation of health and health responses and repressing, you know, the things that would kill us before our time. And so in that sense, I say nutrition causes disease because it's controlling the expression of the genes. Genes don't cause disease, and so this paradigm we're operating in, I don't like to call it a paradigm, but this really weird model that we're working with now, you know, to spend at least $1,000 for every one, $1,000 on some genetic research compared to one for nutrition, I'm that's an underestimate, I'm sure. But we're given this enormous, you know, amount of funding just for genetic research, when it doesn't matter. It's good to know. I don't want to knock genetic research down because it's nice to know. We got, you know, to have, see how things work. But I'd like to look at it from the context of how does that help me understand this complex machine that we call our bodies? You know, it's not to be used as taking, oh, I got this gene, I got that, and oh, here's two here. Like the BRCA1, BRCA2 that erupted in the discussion with Angelina Jolie. Really sad, tragic story. Poor woman, she had to make the decision she had made because they scared her half to death, obviously. Increase in the risk, the size of the risk compared to what other people say. And what's she supposed to do? When in reality, if only the true story were told, you know, about the, not just in the case of breast cancer, but other diseases too, that it really has to do with the expression of the genes and the expression of the genes in terms related to nutrition, obviously provided by food.
You're absolutely correct. Unfortunately, she, like a lot of Americans, and are conditioned by the message. And if the people that control and originate the message are the pharmaceutical industry, then they're going to be giving us their message because that's what they profit from. We're out of time. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing insights with us. The book is Whole, Rethinking the Science of Nutrition. The website is t:campbell.org. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks so much.
Then this concludes our Conversations with the Remarkable Minds interview and our program today. And I want to thank you all for taking your time to listen. Now let's go to our talk back segment. And because I want to give a whole half hour to our guests, which we did, and let's say hello to Luann Panessis, who's in the studio in New York City. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. That was that was amazing. It's so refreshing to have minds like that on PRN. A couple of things. One, very quickly, I mean, I have the great honor of being a volunteer of for taking information on this new retreat, which is shaping up to be one of the most historic retreats that I believe that you will ever have. And I just realized that we have a couple of openings for the first and second week, but for specifically for people that want to help out in terms of getting food set up, and we call it work study. People that want to help out with in the kitchen, people that want to help out outside in the gym and the yoga hut. So if people are interested in something like that, it'll be a reduced rate, of course, but we'll discuss that with you. I believe our number is the 877-627-5065.
Yes.
So have people call 877-627-5065 if you're interested in something like that. I think we're pretty much booked up at this point for our regular
guests. We are booked up. We have no more room for, in fact, we've been booked up from the beginning. After the first announcement, we were booked. It's just that with all things, lectures, screenings, there are people who want to be there and then for legitimate reasons can't be. And then they free up their place, and that's when we'd make additional announcements. But we're full, and we've been full. And anytime someone says, I can't be there for some reason, then we announce that we have a place available, but we're packed now. But for every one of these, I know that there are people who may not, for financial reasons, be able to afford it, even though we might mention this is the least expensive retreat in history for what you're getting. And if you doubt me, there are 100 different places in the United States offering, let's say, a yoga week or a cooking week or a meditation week. Then take a look at their prices. We're doing all that and about one-third the price that they're charging because I'm not taking a penny for it. I'm donating my time for free and because it's a fundraiser for the stations and helping out, and that's what we do. You know, it's like, you know, helping people, especially people, Luann, who do I believe is going to get the best experience? There'll be people who love the cooking classes, especially with Shelley, because she's so much fun. Her sense of humor and her insights and the down-home West Virginia quality, that's a winner. But also the yoga, we've got master yoga teachers, master meditators. The person doing the meditation has been doing it, the healing meditation, classically trained for 40 years. So these are not schlumps. These are really the best people I could find. And also, you're going to be counseling people.
Yes.
But the people who are going to get the most from it are people who want to start a new chapter in their lives and want new insights. into how they can get past their traumas, their problems, their depressions, their anger, their resentments, or get past their blockages and start fresh whole. Now, earlier today, Rick called in. And as you know, Rick and Evelyn were homeless, all kinds of problems and depressed. And now they're back on their journey. And I've helped them for the last 4 months. And no depression. She's lost 70-some pounds. He's lost 50 pounds. They're both capable now of re-entering life instead of continuing on a downward spiral. So I'm looking for people who are going to want to believe in the possibilities of how beautiful life can be. Those are the people who are going to get the most from it. Anyhow, we're out of time. If people, and Lou Anne will speak with you at 877. Again, this is the only number to call. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. And there's no more room for the people who are coming as a full guest. This is for work study. And we have John Talley, great guy, who's going to be, he's done so many of these. People really like John. And so we have, it's going to be a wonderful time. I'm out on the road, and I'll be coming there a few days before just to inspect everything, make sure everything is absolutely ideal with backup systems and inspect all the food, inspect all the, I've already approved all the menus, the teaching menus. It's going to be wonderful. So that's it. We thank you and everyone else. And let's now say hello to Eutrice Lita. Hi, Eutrice.
Hello, Gary. Today we're talking about the protests in Brazil. We're talking about a group in California that says immigration is bad for population stabilization. And we're talking about Obama continuing to wobble.
Well, then let us get into this on the right foot. This is the latest news break, quote from Damascus. Supporters of the United States' 12-year quagmire in Afghanistan cheered the news today that the United States would strive to achieve a seamless transfer of that quagmire to Syria, effective immediately. Army General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, sought to reassure those who were concerned that the U.S. withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan signaled a wavering of the nation's commitment to being mired in open-ended military muddles. Quote, I can tell you right here and now that the United States is every bit as determined to engage in an ill-defined, ill-advised, and seemingly interminable mission in Syria as we were in Afghanistan. General Dempsey said, quote, all that's changing is the zip code. General Dempsey said that the same tribal hatred, sectarian violence, and untrustworthy alliances that made Afghanistan a quicksand-like morass are very much in evidence in Syria. Quote, I am confident that you can be involved in Syria for many, many, many years before figuring out why we're there. So over to you. Have a nice
show. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Find a wheel and it goes round, round, round as it skims along with a happy sound as it goes along the ground, ground, ground till it leads you to the one you love. Then your love will hold you round, round, round in your heart's a song with a brand new sound and your head